came and had Bible classes first, and then after Bible classes, everybody got together in the auditorium for a little bit, and we'd have a song, and then somebody'd give a little talk, and we'd have an invitation, and then the song leader would make a few announcements, and we'd have a prayer and go home. That was the routine. You pick up on that pretty quick. It doesn't take long to figure that out. But this Wednesday night was not routine, right? There in between the song leader sort of making some announcements and that prayer, there was a break in the routine. One of the brothers, before the guy could get up to lead the prayer, he beat him to the pulpit. And he asked everybody to sit down. That was kind of strange. And he began to speak, and it only got worse. He announced that the church was in sin. He and his wife had put up with it as long as they could. And they'd had enough, and they couldn't stay, so they were leaving. And he sat down. And I was freaking out. Everybody just kind of sat there. Because what's supposed to happen after that? We didn't know. Had some pretty sharp elders at that place. One of them knew. He got up. And he came to the mic and he said to this brother, "Well, you've said we're in sin, but you didn't bother to mention what that was." And so he invited the brother to get back up and said, "You should probably tell us what the sin is so we can all know since you've said it in front of all of us." And so he got back up and I'm thinking, this is not going to be good. And so he went on for a while listing what he thought the sins were. And then this elder stood back up and did a masterful job sort of gently walking back through and answering all of that. This went on for a while and finally he finished and we had the prayer and it was done. And I was sitting, I don't know about where you were, Ricky, in that auditorium. First thing I did when that prayer was finished is I turned around scanning the crowd, saying, "Please let there not be any visitors here tonight." I don't think there were. And then in the days that followed, I got a little bigger in thinking about that. And I wondered about our young people. Our teenagers who would be old enough to remember that night and that spectacle. And I wondered about them and what long-term impact this ugly scene that they had witnessed in their church family would have on all of them. It was ugly. And if you stay around God's people long enough, you will have a story to tell like that. Maybe not so dramatic as what I've just described. Maybe it will just be an awkward Bible class. Have you ever had one of those where two brothers disagreed over something that probably shouldn't be nearly as important as they thought it was, and you could just feel the tension get a little high and the voices get a little loud, and it was just uncomfortable? Ever had that happen? Or maybe it will be much worse than I've just described for you. Rather than just a little episode like what I described, maybe you'll have something that'll blow the church up and there'll be a divide and half the people will leave and go start a church somewhere else. That happens too. But make no mistake, as we make our journey from earth to heaven with our brothers and sisters, we will pass through seasons of discord. It is not pleasant. It is among the most discouraging behavior you can experience to see brothers and sisters do ungodly things and express ungodly attitudes in the church family that threaten to pull us apart. But for some, it's more than just discouraging. For some, the bad behavior destabilizes their spiritual foundation and destroys their faith. After 30 years of preaching, I will tell you, rarely do serious seasons of discord pass without casualties. And so over the years that I've been preaching, I've tried to talk a lot about the need for unity and about the need for brethren to love each other and to be together and to try to avoid episodes like these. I've done a lot of preaching about that. Maybe I was shaped by this early experience I had. But I will tell you that as I've grown up a little bit as a preacher, I realized that there was probably something deficient about all that preaching. It surely is important to talk about the need for unity and for us to work hard to be together and to not have episodes like that. But brothers and sisters, no matter how hard we work at it, that storm is coming. And it occurred to me a few years ago that what I had never done was talk about that storm. And what we do when those moments come when we can't avoid, but instead must face our discord. If it is going to happen, how do I process these seasons when brothers and sisters are displaying ungodly attitudes and behaving in ways that create fractures in our church family? How do I pass through that season without losing my faith? That seems to me to be a key piece of this discussion as well. And so since that storm is out there, and I think inevitably comes to every place, that we ought to say some things about that. We need to be able to survive storms of discord. So how do we do that? Let me suggest three things to you this morning. May I just say that you guys have enormous patience. This is the third time y'all have to listen to me in like one morning, and that's just remarkable to me. So God bless you for your patience. But it is over for today after this one, right? We're completely finished, so you can look forward to that. How do we survive storms of discord? Maybe we need to begin with this, that we need to accept reality. You remember we started the discussion of suffering by addressing expectations. And so I want to do that here too. I want to address the problem of discord by addressing our expectations. I think sometimes that may be the root of our problem. I think we have this expectation that because we are among God's people, we shouldn't see discord and strife, right? We expect that in other settings. We just don't expect that here. In fact, I will tell you that I've heard that sentiment expressed on Wednesday night. Surely someone has gotten up here on Wednesday night and said, wasn't this a wonderful reprieve? To be able to come together on a Wednesday night and get away from the world and all the troubles out there in the world and the difficult people we have to deal with and be with all of you. Has anybody ever said that? You see what's behind that? It is that belief that I'm going to be with a different kind of people. You're not like the people I have to work with that are frankly contentious and hard to get along with. And you're like not like my next door neighbor that's dog is always causing trouble for me and always getting on my nerves and I can't reason with them. They're contentious. You're not like them. You're different. Question, what happens when you're not? Y'all notice I'm putting all the blame on you, right? Because that is what we do. What happens when I come to Bible class and I see among God's people the same thing I see out there? Two brothers who raise their voice and exchange harsh words, or two sisters who sit on opposite sides and won't speak to each other because of some unresolved offense in the past, or someone who won't talk to me because of some problem we've had, or worse yet, the assembly is marred by some kind of an angry outburst like I just described for you a moment ago, or worse than that. I thought this was a reprieve. What happens when it's not that way? And we expected it to be so different. I tell you what it is, people get disillusioned. And it destabilizes their faith. My question is that a reasonable expectation? When I look at this through Scripture's lens, is that a reasonable expectation? Because when you read your New Testament, All these New Testament churches are just bastions of peace and unity and togetherness, right? Like Corinth. Y'all really should have laughed louder than that. Y'all need to go through Corinthians again. Right? You know, you flip over to Corinthians, 1 Corinthians. In chapter 1 and verse 1, he begins by talking about the divisions that are among you. And then by chapter 3, he's talking about their immaturity. In chapter 6, they're dragging each other into court. Chapter 11, they've corrupted the Lord's Supper and are mistreating each other in that. In chapter 12, even in their spiritual gifts, they'd found a way to divide from each other. That church was a mess of trouble among themselves. And even if you contend that the Corinthian situation was uniquely bad, it was hardly unique. Look at Jerusalem. How about that episode in Acts 5 with Ananias and Sapphira? I will tell you, folks, we've had some discord in the church that I preach for in Beaumont. We've never had to call the morgue to take away bodies when it was over. How about you? And in the very next chapter, there's this big blow up over widows being neglected in the daily serving of food. And all of that had to be ironed out. And then you get to Acts 15 and the disciples have this huge disruption over the issue of Gentiles and whether or not they have to become Jews before they can be Christians. And what about circumcision? And we're not done. You get to Philippians and the latter part of that letter in chapter 4 and verse 2, Paul calls out a couple of women for a fuss that was going on between them. Wouldn't you like that to be highlighted forever in the New Testament, your personal fuss with somebody? And he warns the Galatians in chapter 5 and verse 15, if they keep fussing with each other, they're going to be consumed by each other. That's the biblical lens. So do you see why my first point on the slide is accept reality? Now, I'll tell you, I don't want you to misunderstand what I'm trying to say. I don't mean to imply that bad behavior that leads to troubles like these is no big deal. In fact, the only reason we know about these troubles is because the New Testament writers are writing to address these troubles. That division mentioned in 1 Corinthians 1 in verse 10, what Paul says is, I don't want division like that. I want you to be of the same mind and of the same judgment. He rebukes them for that. What I'm trying to say is that they did have troubles like these. Disciples did misbehave and it created problems and they fussed with each other. It's not right, it's reality. In Ephesians 4 and verse 3, Paul urges us to be diligent to preserve the unity of the Spirit in the bond of peace. It's important to know some of the details of the language there. That language implies ongoing hard work. What's he saying there? He's saying that unity isn't this thing that we achieve and then put in a nice box and lay on the shelf and we got that accomplished and we move on to something else. What he's saying is this unity thing among the people of God, because we are such a bizarre collection of people, is something that you are going to have to work at all the time and work at really hard. And so we need to align our expectations with that. I need to anticipate that this isn't going to be easy. But in fact, it's going to be hard. That's reality. I need to accept that. When troubles come along, when disciples misbehave, and it creates a fuss or a problem in the church, when we go through a season of discord, I shouldn't be happy about that. But I should say, you know what? That's exactly the kind of thing I should anticipate. It happens. It's part of the New Testament pattern. But doesn't that leave the more fundamental question unanswered? Okay, so that's the way it is, but doesn't it leave you wondering why it's that way? If we all, after all, are supposed to be following Jesus, shouldn't we do better? Shouldn't we really be different than the world around us? And shouldn't we, as a result of that, get along better? So let's pause and let's drill down at that place and talk a little bit about why this is reality. And I think there's a number of things that need to be said about that. Let me mention three. Number one, sometimes the discord among us is the consequence of bad people doing bad stuff that makes trouble. Can we just be honest about that? Over the years that I've been preaching, I've discovered that there are just some folks who are evil. They have evil motives. They're determined to harm other people, and it creates disruption in the church. They only masquerade as true disciples. They're not really serving Jesus. They're doing the work of Satan. We should expect that because it was present in the New Testament. 3 John, that letter, was largely written to address a wicked man that was present in that church, who was causing trouble, and who needed to be dealt with. In Acts chapter 20, beginning of verse 28, Paul would address the Ephesian elders and warn them to be on guard against wolves who might even arise among the eldership and threaten the flock. Evil men doing evil things, making trouble. By the way, folks, that's one of the reasons that the New Testament teaches churches to practice discipline. It's not just a way of dealing with people who haven't shown up for 3 years and we're about to publish a new directory and we don't know what to do with them. Church discipline is really about protecting the flock. And sometimes shepherds have to leave the church in removing people. That's what we see in the New Testament, who are threatening the security and the unity and the soundness of the church. God has given us a prescription to deal with that problem. I want to be clear about something. Bad people doing bad stuff is not the only way to account for discord among God's people. Though I think we are quick to jump to that conclusion, especially when it's bad stuff that hurts me. I want to give you another possibility. Sometimes our discord is the result of good people who do bad stuff. Someone says, how can that be? How can good people do bad stuff? Oh, it isn't hard at all. I'll give you two possibilities. First, sometimes good people do bad stuff because they are spiritually immature. Sometimes bad behavior is not the result of somebody being evil or having bad motives. It's because they are spiritually immature. Hop over to Colossians for a minute. I want to look at something in Colossians chapter 1. I want you to think with me about the process of learning and growing that takes place as Jesus tries to form us into the people that he wants us to be. I love this passage in Colossians 1. Look down at verse 9. In Colossians 1 and 9, Paul says, "For this reason also, since the day we've heard of it, we have not ceased to pray for you and to ask," and here's how the process starts, "that you may be filled with the knowledge of his will in all spiritual wisdom and understanding, so that you may walk in a manner worthy of the Lord to please him in all respects, bearing fruit in every good work and increasing in the knowledge of God." You see how that process works? It begins with a person being filled with the knowledge of his will, which will provide us with understanding and wisdom. And then verse 10, enable us to walk, that is to live a life that will please the Lord and to bear fruit and do good work. You see how that works, right? And you understand that doesn't happen in 2 weeks. You go out and share the gospel with your coworker who never darkened the doorstep of a church building his entire life. Never opened a Bible until you started talking to him about Jesus. And you teach him the gospel and he responds and he becomes a Christian. How much does he know? I mean, he may know nothing about this book. And so he is really all in. And that first year, he studies, he comes to worship, he has private studies. He is really after learning God's will from his life. At the end of 365 days, how much does he know? Yeah, not very much, right? He's still got a long way to go. Let me tell you something about that. As he goes that long way, he's going to blow it. In the meantime, he's going to make some mistakes. And I know he's going to do that because I see it in the Bible. Acts chapter 8. Remember Simon the sorcerer? Who became Simon the New Testament disciple? And he's doing good until he sees the apostles laying their hands on people, imparting gifts, and all of a sudden those old evil roots start making their way back into his heart, and he sees dollar signs. Oh, I got to have that power. And he wants to buy the gift. And Peter has to call him out for that and has to rebuke him for that. He has made a mistake. He has blown it. And I think he's brought to repentance there. But listen, that's how it happens. Even when you're committed, even when you're working, even when you're doing well, when you are new at this, you don't get it all right all the time. You know any new Christians that struggled? With alcohol? With a filthy mouth? With temper issues? Do you struggle with anything the first few years you were a Christian? Were you just bad? Or were you immature? Still had growing to do. Sometimes bad behavior is the result of spiritual immaturity. Secondly, sometimes bad behavior is the result of spiritual weakness. Now I'm thinking about Peter, and I'm thinking about Galatians 2. Peter is not a new Christian in Galatians 2, right? Peter is an apostle who does something colossally dumb in Galatians 2. Some men come up from Jerusalem. He is intimidated by their presence, and he begins to pull back from his relationship with the Gentiles. And because he's Peter, the apostle, not the new Christian, who takes that action, there are other disciples who follow his example. You talk about tearing a church apart, that's about what Peter did. He's about to create a huge problem in these churches because of his terrible example, being intimidated and pulling back from this relationship. Thank heaven for Paul. In chapter 2 and verse 14, who knows exactly what to do? This has to be addressed. And what he does is he calls Peter out before everyone. That's how it had to be handled. You talk about a mess. Two apostles at odds with each other? Now, folks, that's discord. Here's my question. Is Peter just a bad guy? Is he just a wicked man masquerading as a true disciple? I don't think so. I think Peter's a great man with a terrible weakness. And you go back and look at his life, and periodically that same weakness will rear its ugly head. He struggled with it, and it came up again and again and again. And I think we understand that. There are people in this crowd that have been a Christian for decades. Got any weaknesses? Ever struggled with temper? Still battling self-will and pride so that you believe your way is the best way, or knowing where to draw that line between you've said enough or said too much and has gone over into gossip? Ever wrestled with that? Ever had those weaknesses lead you into some ugly failure that created some kind of a little blow-up in the church family, some kind of a problem? Are you just a bad person? Or a person with a weakness? Let me take this a step further. Now plug in the golden rule. When my immaturity or my weaknesses lead to a failure, how do I want other people to treat me? You know, instead of folks jumping to the conclusion that I'm just a bad person doing bad things, making trouble in the church, I'd rather them follow the love impulse from 1 Corinthians 13:7 and assume the best in me. I think maybe David isn't a bad guy. Maybe David's just immature. Or maybe David is just weak in that area. And consider that possibility that I just need some time to grow. I will tell you, brothers and sisters, I have encountered among God's people some genuinely wicked people with bad motives. But not very many. Very few. But I've encountered lots of people who struggled with immaturity and struggled with weaknesses and blundered at times. And sometimes those blunders made messes in the churches. What I'm advocating is this. I'm going to put up the point at the end of it, okay? So I'm not about to jump off in a new direction. I think we need to learn to recode the cause of bad behavior. Instead of leaping to the conclusion that this is just a bad guy doing a bad thing, maybe my first impulse needs to be to say, maybe this person just struggles with that. Maybe they're just spiritually immature. Maybe they're just weak. And I will tell you what, when viewed through that commonly shared lens, it looks like a whole different thing, doesn't it? And I think provokes us to handle it in an entirely different way. Which brings me to the last thing. We've talked a lot this morning about how we mentally process a lot about all of this. What do we actually do during seasons of discord? Let me wrap this up by saying a few things about that. Already, I think we've identified some wrong things to do. Leaving Jesus. I have never understood that. Why would anybody leave Jesus during a season of discord? This brother was mean to me or behaved badly in the church, so I'm leaving Jesus. How is that Jesus' fault? Why am I blaming him? And what have I accomplished by doing that? If ever there were a time that describes cutting off the nose despite the face, that is it. Packing up, or rather, leaving Jesus, always the wrong choice. Packing up and going somewhere else is also often the wrong choice. People do that all the time. There's a little discord, a little problem in the church. People say, you know, it's not very far to drive to that one over there. I'm going to pack up and go somewhere else. Do y'all see the problem with that decision? The problem with that decision is that church across town that I'm going to go to next, guess who's over there? People. And I promise you, if there are people in that church, there will be discord there at some point. So just be there a while, and they're going to go through their season too. And so you'll have to pack up and leave and go somewhere else. I've watched families do that. Knew one family over 5 years, they were in five different churches. Come on, really? What did that accomplish? The second problem with that choice is that it may well deprive God's people of the stability that I may be able to provide. My presence, my example, my admonitions may just be what's needed to help hold things together. And so I would suggest, rather than cutting and running where there's trouble, what we need people to do is we need people to be a pillar. I've met pillars in every church that I've worked with. The people who've been there forever. Which means, if you've been there forever, if you've been here forever, that means you've been here during the good things, and you've been here during the storms, too. But you didn't run away. You stay. Even on those depressing Sunday when things were dark, you still showed up and you worshiped and you taught class and you did your thing. Maybe you were some key component in helping work out the problems, and your presence helped hold things together. In the middle of this awful storm, while the winds were blowing, you were a pillar that helped hold up the house. God bless you. Church needs pillars. That needs some balance, doesn't it? I made that point one time, and I'm looking at the crowd at a good friend of mine who had left. And I thought that point needs some balance. Because he had stayed. He had stayed a long time. He saw the apostasy coming. He had identified the false teacher. He confronted the false teacher. He had gone to the elders and warned them of the false teacher. He had stood against it for years, and it became clear after years he had lost the battle in that church and conscientiously could no longer stay. I am not saying this morning there is never a time to leave. At the end of the battle over truth and error, when truth doesn't carry the day, I know there's a time where you may have to go. Does that give the balance that's needed there? It just needs to be sure. We need to be sure it's at the end of the battle over truth and error that we make that choice that we may need to go. That's what not to do. Don't cut and run. Don't walk away from Jesus. What should we do then during seasons of storm? How about letting Jesus be the teacher on this? Matthew 5 verse 9. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called the sons of God. Romans 14 and 19. So then we pursue the things which make for peace and the building up for one another. Ephesians 4, 3. Being diligent to preserve the unity of the Spirit and the bond of peace. And I wrote all those things down and I thought, boy, that's easy just to quote three passages, right? What does that look like? Maybe I need to be the person who will stand shoulder to shoulder and support the leadership when they must remove the wicked man sowing discord in the church. Leaders need that support. Maybe I will need to play Paul's role in Galatians 2. Maybe I'm just the person who can go to Peter and say, brother, you're wrong about this. Maybe you're the voice that he will listen to. And you can call him out and bring him back in the fold. Maybe you're just the person to take a new Christian under your wing and help them grow to maturity and deal with some of their faults and weaknesses that cause disruption. Or maybe you can just be here and be optimistic no matter what else is going on, and tenaciously love God's people even when they're really hard to love, and just be a pillar that weathers the storm, because it is coming. And the question is, will we let the storm destroy us, or will we be a pillar who helps to foil the efforts of the devil to destroy us? And that's what this is. I won't preach the sermon, but we need to say a whole lot more about the devil. Because, folks, he's the one that's behind all of that. And at the end of the day, that's really the question. Do we play into his hand and let him win and destroy us? Or do we stand with God and resist him? He's at work right now. Do you realize that? He's at work in this crowd. Maybe there's someone sitting here. Things are not right between you and God, and something has been said today or in the last few days that stirred your heart about that. You know, the devil right now wants more than anything to keep you from acting on what you know to be true and right, and to make things right with you and your God. He wants to get in your way. He wants to destroy you. So the question to be answered at the end of this service is whether or not he's going to win. Will God have a victory today because you come back home? Or will the devil have the victory because you listen to whatever it is he's putting in your mind to keep you from coming down here? What we're praying for today, and what God looks down from heaven hoping for today, is that God will win. He will have the victory. Defeat the devil. Let God win. You respond to him. Come to him today. Come down front while we stand, while we sing.